College English Test, Band 6, Part 2, Listening Comprehension. Section A, Directions. In this section, you will hear two long conversations. At the end of each conversation, you will hear four questions. Both the conversation and the questions will be spoken only once. After you hear a question, you must choose the best answer from the four choices marked A, B, C, and D. Then mark the corresponding letter on answer sheet 1 with a single line through the center. Conversation 1.
We are down to two candidates for one position, and we need to decide by the end of the day in order to finalize this whole procedure.
Yes, but it isn't an easy choice to make. Both applicants are quite strong.
Let's get to it then. Both of them went to good universities, and both of them studied business-related subjects. So, academically, I'd say they're pretty much the same. What do you think?
I would agree, yes. The only difference worth noting, perhaps, is that it looks like Rachel scored moderately stronger grades throughout high school and university. But as I said, only a tiny bit higher than Peter.
That's true, and worth noting. Thank you. In addition, Rachel interviewed very well. I thought she came across as bright and alert.
Yes. She asked some very good questions about the position and the company, which made me think she is very keen about the job.
I thought so too. Now let's look at Peter's interview performance. I thought he also did very well. He came across as respectful and professional, wouldn't you say? Calm and poised, very mature for his age.
Exactly. In my notes, I wrote that he seemed composed and in control of his emotions. I think he definitely looked more mature than Rachel.
Interesting. So we agree that Rachel appeared inexperienced and less mature than Peter, even though both candidates are the same age and have practically no work experience.
When comparing them side by side, yes, Peter seemed more self-assured somehow. Maybe it was something about their body language.
Sure, maybe he was simply less nervous.
Maybe. Who knows? To be honest, I think I like Rachel better.
Really? I think I like Peter.
Ah, well, if there's a tie and we can't come to an agreement, then we'll take it to John and let him cast the deciding vote.
Questions 1 to 4 are based on the conversation you have just heard. Question 1. Why does the man think it is difficult to make the decision? Question 2. What do the speakers say may be worth noting? Question 3. According to the man, what might account for Peter appearing somewhat more self-assured than Rachel? Question 4. What does the man say they will do if they can't reach an agreement? Conversation 2.
We're here with Clementine Ortega, head designer of the private fashion label L'Orange, to discuss her latest collection. Ms. Ortega, how would you describe this season's look?
To be honest, my preferred style has always been on the ambiguous side, and I think this collection is even more so. I try not to adhere to social norms and expectations. Rather, I always try to incorporate something slightly absurd into my aesthetic.
The assortment of accessories in this collection have had quite the impact on critics. The dazzling cape deployed at the end of the show, for example, bewildered many in the audience. What was your inspiration for this piece?
Over the summer, I traveled through rural mountain villages throughout Asia in search of handicrafts to decorate my new studio with. The embroidery done by the women in a particular village was so exquisite, I couldn't stop thinking about it. Trying to recreate their designs would have been futile, so instead I applied my own eccentric approach. Using glitter, I drew similar intricate patterns onto the velvet cape. This ended up in the glamorous, luminous look that concluded the show.
It was indeed majestic, and yet, dare I say, masculine at the same time.
Well, yes, that was intentional. I like to merge styles that are often at opposite ends of the fashion spectrum. Hence, the sparkling cape was paired with a traditional power suit you would typically see in a business setting. It was sensational, if I do say so myself.
Spectacular for sure. A stunning show all around. Going against stereotypes, the incorporation of indigenous aspects, along with your underlying signature touch, made this collection a statement of the season. You have proven yourself a formidable young designer, and we can't wait to see what creations you come up with next.
Questions 5 to 8 are based on the conversation you have just heard. Question 5. What are the speakers mainly talking about? Question 6. What does the woman say she always tries to incorporate into her aesthetic? Question 7. What does the woman say she likes to do? Question 8. What is the man looking forward to?
Section B. Directions. In this section, you will hear two passages. At the end of each passage, you will hear three or four questions. Both the passage and the questions will be spoken only once. After you hear a question, you must choose the best answer from the four choices marked A, B, C, and D. Then mark the corresponding letter on answer sheet 1 with a single line through the center.
Passage 1. Pet dogs can often readily understand a wide range of their owner's commands and gestures. But are these abilities inborn, or are they exclusively learned through training? To find out, a new study examined whether stray dogs could understand human gestures. The study revealed that 80% of participating dogs successfully followed pointing gestures to a specific location, despite having never received prior training. The results suggest that dogs can understand complex gestures by simply watching humans. This could have implications in reducing conflict between stray dogs and humans. Dogs were domesticated 10,000 to 15,000 years ago. This means they are probably the oldest domesticated animals on the planet. Humans then bred dogs with the most desirable and useful traits so that they could function as companions and workers. This resulted in domesticated dogs that are highly responsive to human commands and gestures. However, it was not clear whether dogs understand us through training alone, or whether this was an inherent ability. Why does this matter? Stray dogs are a common feature in cities around the world. They may observe and occasionally interact with people. But such dogs have never been trained and are behaviorally wild. Conflicts between stray dogs and humans are a problem. Understanding how humans shape stray dogs' behavior may help alleviate this problem. According to the researchers of the new study, stray dogs are intelligent creatures. They closely observe humans and use their understanding of us to make a decision. Treating stray dogs with sensitivity and respect, and giving them space, the researchers assert, can reduce much conflict.
Questions 9 to 11 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 9. What does the passage say about 80% of participating dogs in the new study? Question 10. What may help alleviate the problem caused by stray dogs? Question 11. What do the researchers suggest we do to reduce conflicts between stray dogs and humans? Passage 2. Think your refrigerator is just one big box of evenly cold air? Not so. The temperature inside the average fridge actually varies from front to back, bottom to top, and everywhere in between. Because of this, food product placement within the appliance is far more important than you probably realize. The whole purpose of the modern refrigerator is to slow the growth of bacteria, which thrive in temperatures from 4.4 to 60 degrees Celsius. As a result, refrigerators are typically set at or below that low end to protect foods against bacteria. Although it might seem like time spent organizing the fridge will spoil your day, doing so will actually make it more user-friendly, easier to clean, and food safety conscious. Those little bins on the inside of refrigerator doors are convenient, but they don't maintain a consistent temperature, so definitely refrain from putting perishable foods in there. The top area is not as cold as the bottom of the fridge, so save it for the foods that don't need extra chilly temperatures. Store foods that are ready to eat or already cooked on the top shelf. The middle shelf is the most temperature-controlled part of the fridge, so place eggs here. Drinks and prepared foods can also live on the middle shelf if you run out of room up top. The back of the bottom shelf is the coldest spot in the fridge, so store perishable dairy products here to keep them edible longer. Never store foods with high water content here because the water within them can and will freeze, effectively ruining them.
Questions 12 to 15 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 12. Why is food product placement within the fridge very important? Question 13. What does the passage say is the whole purpose of the modern refrigerator? Question 14. Where in the fridge should we store foods already cooked? Question 15. Why should we never store foods with high water content at the back of the bottom shelf?
Section C. Directions. In this section, you will hear three recordings of lectures or talks, followed by three or four questions. The recordings will be played only once. After you hear a question, you must choose the best answer from the four choices marked A, B, C, and D. Then, mark the corresponding letter on answer sheet 1 with a single line through the centre.
Recording 1. My current research is mainly looking at factors like stress and how it affects our immune system. So the current projects that I'm quite excited about are looking at older people and factors that are important to them. In one project, we're looking at hip fracture in older people, which is a common event, and we're trying to understand the impact of depression. Often, people in hospital with a hip fracture develop depression, and these are the people that then go on to become feeble a lot more quickly than others. They get infections. Often, these infections lead to death. So we're trying to slow down that progression to feebleness. So if we can better understand how these factors interact, then we can actually start doing something about it. The impact that my research will have in Birmingham, first of all, is obviously for older people, because these are the people that are having hip fractures and developing depression, and we're trying to improve their health and their quality of life. But this isn't just a problem in Birmingham or even in the UK. This is a problem globally. People are aging. There's a lot more people in the older generation who are living for longer, but not necessarily staying healthy for a large part of their lives. So the last part of their life can often be full of ill health, and we're trying to understand factors that can contribute to the quality of life later on. I think the thing that excites me most about my research is that it feels real and relevant. Lots of academics are probably very excited about their research, but it might not be that relevant to those around them. Whereas I feel that the work I do is relevant to everyone because everyone is aging. Health is an issue for everyone regardless of their age, and what I'm trying to do is understand the factors that affect health and how we can improve the quality of life in people. So that's one of the things that really excites me about it. One of the other things is rather than just taking one perspective, so rather than looking at aging and health just from the perspective of the psychologist, we are now bringing together a lot of different techniques and a lot of different viewpoints to actually look at the sort of different factors affecting health.
Questions 16 to 18 are based on the recording you have just heard. Question 16. What does the speaker say is quite common among older people? Question 17. What does the speaker think excites her most about her research? Question 18. How does the speaker approach her research project? Recording 2. Americans are obsessed with celebrity chefs. We talk about them and try to eat like them. But could we learn something more from them than recipes and techniques? According to Market Data Enterprises, Americans spend nearly $10 billion a year on self-help and personal organization products. The market is huge, partly because most colleges and graduate schools don't teach basic organization, but cooking schools and professional kitchens do. Perhaps the principles of cooking organization can be extended to help even those of us who aren't top chefs. The system that makes kitchens function is called mise en place, or literally put in place. It's a French phrase that means to gather and arrange the ingredients and tools needed for cooking. But for many professional cooks, the phrase means something deeper. Some cooks call it their religion. It helps them coordinate vast amounts of labor and material and transforms the lives of its practitioners through focus and self-discipline. Students at the Culinary Institute of America view it as a way of life. It's a way of concentrating their mind to only focus on the aspects that they need to be working on at the moment to kind of rid themselves of distractions. And it's a habit that some students carry with them even when they're not in the kitchen. They mise en place their life. They set up their books for class. They set up their chef whites. They shine their shoes. They know everything that they need every step of the day. Then, how does one attain this level of organization? The key to high-level organization is the mindset. Cooks can easily do 6 hours of preparation for a 3-hour dinner shift. Mise en place forces cooks to account for every minute of their time and every movement. Every component of one single dish is in one single corner, so their hand literally moves inches, explains Dwayne Limpuma, an instructor at the Culinary Institute of America. Once students set up their station, I should be able to cover up their eyes, and they should know that their knives are always here, their oil is always right here, their salt and pepper is always right here. But practiced at its highest level, mise en place says that time is precious, resources are precious, space is precious, your self-respect and the respect of others are precious. Use them wisely. Isn't that a philosophy for our time?
Questions 19 to 21 are based on the recording you have just heard. Question 19. What does the speaker say about most colleges and graduate schools in America? Question 20. How do students at the Culinary Institute of America view mise en place, or put in place? Question 21. What does the speaker advise us to do at the end of the talk? Recording 3. Why do we stop making goals for ourselves and stop progressing in life? One reason is the belief that we should accept who we are and not constantly strive to improve ourselves. The mistake we make with this is that, whilst self-acceptance is imperative, it should actually be used as the basis for growth. When we're not growing, learning, and seeking improvements in our lives, we tend to stagnate, accepting what is, and stop believing we can be better. A key tool for creating goals and progressing is using our imagination. Yet, as is so often the case, by the time we've reached midlife, we've stopped dreaming about what we want to achieve and feel quite negatively about goal setting. Instead of feeling confidence, happiness, and satisfaction from achieving our goals, we feel we are always falling short. That leads to disappointment, and we stop dreaming. We stop imagining the life we'd like to have or the person we'd like to be, quickly finding ourselves shattered by the pain of our reality. Up until now, unless we work in the creative industry, we've found the idea of using play a bit childish. In the West, we're mostly operating from our heads, the rational mind. But it's beginning to be better understood, because using our imagination is actually one of the most powerful things we could ever do. The problem with finding ourselves irritated for not achieving the goal is because the goal always changes, and we're always adapting, whether we realize it or not. What happens, therefore, is that we end up feeling like we're never going to reach our goals. And herein lies one of the biggest misconceptions and reasons for failure, dissatisfaction, and unhappiness. We measure against the goal rather than where we've come from. Dan Sullivan calls this the gap and the gain. We measure always against the goal, which we never feel we're reaching, rather than the gain, that is, where we've come from. In measuring where we've come from rather than where we're trying to get to, we see results. We see things we've taken for granted or not noticed. It's a simple yet profound change in perception. And what I love about it is the power it has to instantly shift us up a gear. It's so simple, yet has an immediate positive impact on our thinking.
Questions 22 to 25 are based on the recording you have just heard. Question 22. What should self-acceptance be used as, according to the speaker? Question 23. What do people tend to do when they have reached midlife? Question 24. Why do we find ourselves irritated for not achieving the goal? Question 25. What does the speaker say has an immediate positive impact on our thinking?
That's the end of listening comprehension.